Well, my maternal grandmother is of German origin, Pennsylvania Dutch, but the gaudy Dutch rather than the plain Dutch. Everyone whom I say Pennsylvania Dutch to immediately thinks Amish, and do you know the difference?
I don't know the difference. I've heard the term, so why don't you explain that?
Well, all of those Dutch religions were offshoots, essentially, of Lutheranism. They all started in, oh, the Germany area of the old Weimar Republic in Europe. And they came over here, and there was a man named Ammon who broke off the Plain People. The essential difference between the Amish and the Mennonites are called plain because they are very plain. They dress plainly, they live very simply. The gaudy Dutch are the ones that paint hex signs on the barns. That's why they're called gaudy, Gaudy. And so my mother's family comes from that kind of a background.
What was their name?
Espenlaub.
You want to spell that?
Yeah, it's Espenlaub. And they came over in the early 1700s. And they were woodworkers from Germany area. And they did all kinds of woodwork. When I was a child, they were working as carpenters, the men in the family, building the finished woodwork on private railroad cars. You've probably seen the one over at Henry Flagler's, that kind of fancy woodwork. And we have a few pieces of furniture left in the family that they made, and very ornate turn-of-the-century Victorian-type stuff, real fancy carvings and things of that nature. But with the woodwork also went the basketry background. It's similar type of work, and you use the same kinds of materials.
Now, were the women of the family the basket makers and the men?
No, the men, at least when I was a child, were. And I think that was because in my mother's family, the baskets were made out of veneer-type strips of oak. I have one in the back here, if it would help to show it to you.
Yeah, if you want to get it now, you can get it later.
Whatever is easier.
So it was a veneer?
Well, you cut them with veneer-making tools, the strips. And they made the kind of baskets that are riveted rather than bound at the top, similar to commercial bushel baskets are today, that kind of thing. During the Depression, my grandfather was a farmer in Towanda area, outside Towanda, and was hard up for money like everybody else. So he started making baskets to sell. And that was the first time that I know of in the family that baskets became any kind of a serious money-making commodity in the family. So he farmed, and then he made baskets on the side and sold that. And being on a farm and during the Depression, he really wasn't too badly off. There was lots to eat, but and there was no income taxes back then. There were no utility payments to make. He probably needed money to pay taxes on the farm and to buy things like sugar and coffee that they couldn't grow themselves. So he probably had relatively little need for cash, and they got that during the Depression by selling baskets and by selling butter. He said that all during the Depression, I can remember being told this as a child, that they never ate butter and they spread lard and bacon grease on their toast in the morning because the butter was very valuable and they sold that. This was on a dairy farm that they could not afford to eat butter themselves, so that's where their income came from. So after the Depression, when things got better, he stopped making baskets and he lived until I was about 30, and he never made a basket in my lifetime, so he was never going to do that again. That was Depression work. But my mother learned as a child to make baskets, and she continued to do so just as a hobby, and she made very fine, work-intensive house baskets, and I have two of her baskets still that she made and designed as pocketbooks. Now, also in the family, in a different branch of the family, they made rye straw baskets, coiled baskets bound with usually white oak strips or something similar, and they were not made to sell. I have one of those. And they were very utilitarian farm work baskets. The one I've got was made to for bread rising. There's some big hamper type things that they stored goose feathers in to like get enough to make a pillow out of. And those would be lidded baskets. So they were real plain, very utilitarian coiled baskets made with exactly the same technique the Seminole Indians use here. They just used, instead of pine needles, they used rye straw. And they chose rye because that has the tallest grain, so you get the longest strands. And then they just bound it with something strong that they had, which in that area it would be either brown ash or white oak strips. Probably brown ash, I would guess, is the most common, but I'm just guessing here. So, from that background, I learned to make baskets as a child from my mother, because my mother did a lot of handwork, and she taught my brothers and me, and I make baskets quite a lot. One of my brothers makes baskets occasionally, and the other brother doesn't make baskets at all.
How many brothers do you have? Two?
I have two brothers, yeah.
And are they still in Pennsylvania?
No, they're both in Seattle.
Oh my gosh.
As a matter of fact. Mm-hmm.
What were some of the first things that your mother taught you? Well, first, how did she know that you were at all interested? Did you indicate an interest, or did she just show them to you?
I can't even remember. I started doing baskets when I was real little. Mm-hmm. I would guess just kids hanging around wanting to get their fingers in it. When we were making baskets, we didn't sit down and make a whole basket. The way it worked for me and for some of my cousins that make a few baskets too is somebody would weave the bottom and turn up the sides. Getting a basket started is always a little awkward because you have to hold on to a lot of things until you get the weaving started. So somebody would do that and turn up the sides, and then we would weave around the sides, which is pretty plain, straightforward weaving. And then we would hand it back and somebody else would attach the rim and the handles. So the first thing we did was weaving the sides. The next thing we did would be to do the bottom and turn up the sides. And then the last thing we learned was putting on rims and handles. So we never really learned. It was probably several years before I just sat down and made a whole basket start to finish by myself.
Do you remember that basket at all, or have you made so many since then?
I've still got it.
Really?
It's in poor shape. Definitely a child's work. Well, I was younger than 8. I don't know. 6, 7, 8, something like that. Pretty little. I would guess as soon as I had enough hand coordination and patience, and I didn't make it all at one sitting. I don't normally now make baskets all at one sitting. I don't normally now have enough time to make a whole basket at once. You know, I make it in bits and pieces when I have time to pick it up and work on them.
What are the principal parts of a basket?
Probably depends on the basket.
What are your baskets used for? And let's talk about maybe the most complicated basket.
Well, since I'm making baskets commercially, I tend to make baskets that I can sell easily rather than baskets that I would like to be making.
What about the willow baskets? Did you make
willow? Mm-hmm. Willow baskets.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing you do, of course, is you have to get the willow. And that involves putting on a pair of galoshes and going out. Willow tends to grow in swampy areas. So you go out and you cut the willow, and you can cut it any time of the year. I think that it's a little easier to cut it when there are no leaves on it, because otherwise you have to strip off the leaves. So,
where do you go?
Well, I was in Tennessee 2 weeks ago. I cut some in Tennessee.
Maybe in Florida?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, there's willow in Florida. I don't like to cut it here because swampy areas here tend to have a lot of water moccasins in them. If you notice driving along the turnpike, the canals on the edge of the turnpike, do you know what a willow leaf looks like? Willow leaf is long. It'll be between 3 and 5 inches long and quite narrow, and it usually has slightly...
Right,
yeah.
Right,
Yeah, and the willow that I've seen growing here in swampy areas is fairly scrubby, short, like 10 feet tall, full-grown, scrubby. What you want with willow are long, straight, fairly straight pieces. You can weave with short pieces, but then you keep adding on and the basket's weaker, so you want the longest pieces that you can get. Some varieties of willow are a whole lot better than others. Weeping willow is not very good because it tends to be brittle when it's dry. You want a piece that has a good bit of tensile strength and retains some flexibility even when it's dried out a good bit. So getting the willow here in Florida is a problem. I can't find any good willow here, so I cut it up north and bring it back, or get somebody up there to cut it for me and send it down, something like that. You can buy it commercially, too. There's a couple places now that sell it. Somebody in Michigan or New York or someplace up there who's importing it from England. I've not seen any of that willow, so I don't know what that works like. I suppose it depends on what you call a basket. My own opinion of a basket is that to be a good basket, it has to be something that can carry all that it will hold. This is the old family definition here. Many baskets that are very decorative can't do that. Some of them nowadays are just designed to be fiber sculpture, and that's fine, but I can't do that myself. I was taught as a child that when you look at a basket, you need to look and see if there are holes in it big enough for chicken feed to fall through, and if there are holes that big, that basket's no good. You know, I haven't fed a chicken for 20 years, and honest to God, every basket I look at, I see whether or not chicken feed can fall through, and if there are holes that big, I figure it's no good. And I just cannot break myself of thinking like that. So I'm really not at all into the sculptural end of basketry. I'm into functional, useful baskets. And I think they can be beautiful, too. And I try to make my baskets beautiful, but I think first they have to be strong and functional, and strong enough to withstand abuse and last for a long, long time.
Now, are your family's baskets the willow baskets?
Some of them are willow, some of them are rye straw, some of them are these veneer-type splints.
So there's a bottom?
There's a bottom. There are sides. There is usually a rim, a reinforced rim. There are sometimes handles. There might be one handle across the middle, or maybe two handles on either end of a laundry basket. Sometimes there is a lid.
And would the lid be hinged on necessarily?
The lid?
Yeah.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It depends on what you're going to use the basket for. My family does not usually, nobody in my family normally hinges them on, though everybody does occasionally. The big reason to put a hinge on is if you're afraid the lid might become lost. So picnic baskets are the ones that they're commonly hinged onto, and toy baskets.
Mm-hmm. What? Your family, they use baskets for everything or anything in particular? Chicken feed?
Well, on the farm, we used them. When I was a kid, we were still using baskets, and then they've been pretty much phased out, even while I was a child, and replaced by things like galvanized buckets from the hardware store. We used them for gathering in the garden, apple trees, wild berries, nuts, that sort of thing. We used them for carrying just loads from here to the neighbors, or laundry in from the yard, and various kinds of carrying tasks. And then we use some for storage, too. We would store goose feathers in them for pillows. We would store various types of fruit. We had a cold cellar, a cool cellar, I guess it actually was, where we stored apples and cabbage and squash, winter vegetables. And most of those were stored in baskets.
Baskets take on the shape of, you know, say the load. If say, could you customize a basket to fit a particular kind of vegetable?
When we were, until recently, when baskets got to be a popular decorating item, when anybody sat down to make a basket, you knew what it was going to be used for, and you planned it to suit. You planned it to suit the purpose and also suit the person. So if you were making baskets for children to gather nuts in, you made small baskets, ones that children could carry, and you made them deep enough so that if the kids tended to swing them around, that the nuts would not fall out. You'd plan children's baskets to be half full when they were fully loaded. For garden baskets, we always made baskets that had round bottoms because you'd be setting them down on uneven ground. A flat bottom basket would tend to tip, while a round bottom basket you could kind of nestle down in the clumps of dirt and it would stay upright. Laundry baskets we usually just made big and broad and flat bottom because you'd be setting them down on the lawn underneath the clothesline. So each basket was made with a purpose in mind, and when I make a basket to use myself at home, I usually know what I'm going to do with it and make it to suit that purpose. Not that I don't occasionally use some basket for something else, but my baskets at home tend to be pretty special purpose baskets, and I don't usually use one that I made to serve bread in at the table to go out and pick oranges with.
What do you use your baskets for?
Well, storage still. I have one basket that I use to store Tupperware lids that I made to hold all of my Tupperware lids upright. I know, an archaic fiber construction for something as modern as that, but Tupperware lids are a nuisance to store, and this keeps them all in line, and I sized that basket to fit my largest Tupperware lid and made the sides high enough so they wouldn't tip over. I use them for various kind of storage tasks like that. I have another one in the bathroom that holds jars of shampoo and deodorant and that kind of thing. Several like that around the house. I have one that I refer to as my brief basket. Other people have brief cases, but I carry my things to work in a basket. And that one I have made large enough. It has a good strong handle on it, and large enough so that it will hold even legal-sized documents flat. I think it's in the back room somewhere right now. So I use them a good bit for carrying. I have a couple of large general-purpose baskets that I carry things around to places where I'm going. I have one quite large basket that I carry basket materials in when I'm going out to do a demonstration. Just large. So I use them for carrying and storage. I don't do very much gathering since I live in town now.
What brought you to Florida?
My father bought some McDonald's stock years ago and made some money in the stock market and decided he was going to not shovel snow anymore in the wintertime. So he retired when I was not quite college age, and so we moved to Florida then with my father, who was retiring, and went to college here and married a Florida boy and lived here ever since.
Do you ever... When you're weaving a basket, do you ever think of when you were growing up in Pennsylvania? Does it ever bring you back?
Sure.
What kind of memories do it bring back?
Well, one of the things that I do is think about that if I make a mistake. One of the things I can remember my mother telling me is that weaving mistakes don't usually show very much. But I can remember her telling me as a child that you should always fix a mistake in a basket you make for yourself, because your eye will go to it every single moment, even a minor mistake. If you're going to give the basket away or sell it, it doesn't matter so much because nobody else will notice minor mistakes. But I can remember her telling me that for myself, I always have to fix them. So I think about that, and I think about getting them tight enough so chicken feed won't fall through. One of the things that was drummed into us was that the rims had to be very strong on baskets that you were carrying anything in. If you're picking oranges, I suppose, be more likely than apples here, and dropping them in one after the other, it's real likely that they will hit on the rim while they're bouncing in. And so rims in old baskets, if you look at old baskets in museums, if they're damaged any place, it's going to be on the rim. And we were always told that ours had to be so strong that you could bounce bricks off of them, and mine probably are. I still feel very strongly that a reinforced rim is real important.
What's the rim made of?
Usually the same material the basket is. Just several layers, and then an inner rim and an outer rim, and bound together so that they'll be good and strong. Packing of peppers.
They have to be packed in a very special way so that they don't bruise and burst.
And green peppers, you mean?
Yeah. And they have to be packed. You can't pack the crate full.
Mm-hmm.
but there's a way to pack it so it will seem full. And I, that's what made me think of the baskets. You know. So you got your baskets in the bag?
Mm-hmm.
See if I can see?
Sure. Professionally, that some baskets are called by people from different parts of the country by the same names that I use, and some are called by different names.
Mm-hmm. Now, the willow basket that you had in there that couldn't hold chicken feed, what would you call that?
I would have called it a crazy basket. I met a woman who's a professional basket maker in Wisconsin, Char Terbeest. She's a Scandinavian. Charlene is her first name, and her last name is TERBEEST, it's Scandinavian. It means the animal or the beast. She makes baskets similar to that, too, and she calls them earth baskets. And I've met another woman who called them life baskets. Well, tangled skeins of life bound together, I guess, something like that. But I just made them as a kid, and we called them crazy baskets because that's what they were back then. There's more names. The shape of that basket, the willow basket, is one that we always called a melon basket because it's, if you look at the bottom of it, it's ribbed on the outside like half a cantaloupe. Up through the Appalachians, they often call those egg baskets. When you get more of a fanny shape to the basket, we called them, and the Pennsylvania Dutch commonly do, call them fanny or buttocks baskets. And there's a German word that I'm not sure I can think of now that's almost buttocks, and it has that meaning. In the Appalachian, they often call those egg baskets. Sometimes they call them gizzard baskets. The Appalachians are not quite as precise. They don't differentiate. An egg basket might be what I would call a melon basket or a fanny basket. Same, very, very similar, but slightly different shaping, and we would differentiate between that, and not everyone does.
What about the spacing? Does the spacing have anything to do with it?
No.
What you called the crazy basket, that could hold eggs. There's a pretty good one.
We use baskets like that usually to hold apples. They're, with the open, when you store apples for the winter, one thing you need to have is good air circulation. And with that, the basket was more than an inch thick in most places and fairly open. So if you set fruit on a shelf with that, you'd still get good air circulation around it. And that's, that would be the purpose for that basket there. Some of the baskets we called by their name, I mean their name and what we used it for. So we would have, within the family, if you ask someone to fetch the apple basket, they would bring that one and not the potato basket. Sometimes baskets are described by makers. There is one basket that I've heard several different people from Michigan refer to as a Meg Thompson basket. We always made baskets like that that we used for kindling, and I always called them a kindling basket because they held kindling wood next to the wood stove in the kitchen. So you get, what, since I've been professionally interested in, yes, and it, and even within regions, individual variations.
So there's the regional variation. Does the basket ever take on personality to you? Does it start looking like a potato?
I can see that melon baskets look like half a cantaloupe. Nah. Mm-mm.
You told me that when, you know, you'd sometimes think of things in Pennsylvania when you were making the basket. When you're making the basket, you can pretty much make it in any space. It's a matter of being able to manipulate the willow, manipulate the strips, at least. You need the art room to do it.
Oh, yes.
Do you feel like you need any kind of, you know, I guess I was asking this in the saddle maker. We were talking about, because his work is so close up. He's going to literally just move on it, flip it into it. There's this kind of connection that he says he feels sometimes with the leather, with the tools. Do you ever think about that? Does that ever happen to you? You feel it's like you become the basket?
Well, sometimes if I have some rough material I'm working with and cut my fingers, a little blood remains in the basket. I'm not sure I think about it that philosophically. I grew up thinking baskets were just simply utilitarian tools, and until the last 10 years, I never thought there was anything. I never talked about my baskets, and nobody was interested in hearing about them or looking at them, and baskets were just something that you did because you couldn't afford to buy something at the hardware store or couldn't find exactly what you wanted. So it's only been very recently that I've started to think that baskets had any artistic importance or personal importance. They were just something like darning a sock. You know, you just did it because you had to and not because there was any philosophical connection. No, I know some people, I've heard other basket makers even say that, and I don't at all. I can see some connection with what I'm doing in some of my relatives. I sometimes choose patterns or colors that other people in my family do, and so there's that kind of a connection. But then I give my baskets away and sell them, and that's lost. The people who have the baskets, if it isn't me, don't ever think about them. He'll get that.
Do you have any specific or particular trademark? Say, if somebody knew your work, could they look at a bunch of baskets and say, that's very great?
Some knowledgeable basket makers have told me that they can pick out my baskets. I can pick out my baskets. If there's nothing particular on it. I don't add, some basket makers do add a particular kind of embellishment to every single basket that they do, so theirs are immediately recognizable. I don't do that kind of thing. I often sign them and date them. I've started to do that again recently since I've stopped thinking of them as just strictly utilitarian tools.
So you mean there's no pattern in your weaving that you call yours?
No. The one thing that I'm tend to be a little vain about is that I think my baskets are extremely well made, and I don't think all baskets are. And I think in 50 years you could tell the difference between my basket and somebody else's. Mine are all going to be here in 50 years. I think that might have been farm training where sturdy baskets were important. If you didn't make it sturdy in the beginning, you had to go back and repair it later anyway, so you might as well make it sturdy when you started.